WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when Philip Roth was accused of being a Jewish anti-Semite for writing about Jewish middle-class life in a humorous and not always flattering way. His early books, Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint, brought him early fame. He's now regarded as among our foremost writers. What it means to be Jewish is a theme that continues to preoccupy Roth in his new novel, Operation Shylock. Another of his favorite themes is in this novel, the line between truth and fiction. The main character is named Philip Roth. On a trip to Israel, he meets a man posing as Philip Roth, using the famous writer's name to get publicity for his cause. The plot is quite convoluted, and Roth would like readers to believe it is truth, not fiction. As improbable as that may be, at least some of what happens to the Philip Roth character happened to the real Roth. In the preface, Roth explains that a few years ago, after minor knee surgery, his pain kept getting worse. His doctor prescribed pills, and Roth's mind soon began to disintegrate.
This disintegration was induced by the sleeping pill called Halcyon.
Mm-hmm.
The book goes on from the little section you just referred to describe in length my discovery that I was having a drug-induced psychosis.
Was it the first time that you experienced that kind of mental and physical disintegration?
I've experienced nothing like it before in my life, and nothing like it since. It was truly horrible. I believe many people will be familiar with William Styron's book, Darkness Visible,
Yeah. And
in which he describes his depression. Well, I don't know if all those readers of Darkness Visible will have seen Styron's piece in The Nation about 2 or 3 months ago about his experience with the same drug, Halcyon. And he now seems to feel, using that article in The Nation as by reference, that Halcyon played a very powerful part in bringing about his true catastrophe, which I must say was even worse than my own.
Did you think you were going crazy at
yes.
the time?
Yes, I thought I was crazy. I thought I had gone crazy. I didn't know why. It's so unlike anything. Although I certainly made my best effort in the book, in Operation Shylock, in describing it. It's inappropriate for a writer to say that words can't describe it, since that's my job. But there's a measure of pain and disorientation that is truly unimaginable to me. By the way, even now, however many years later it is, it's unimaginable to me. All I know is I don't take any pills of any kind. I don't even take my aspirin any longer.
I want to talk with you a little bit more about ordeals, if that's okay. I'd like to refer back to your recent book, Patrimony, which was about the last period of your father's life before he died at the age of 88 from a brain tumor. And you took care of him near the end. And certainly the impression I got from the book is that as difficult an ordeal as that was for him to be sick, and as difficult as it was for you to take care of him, that you were really glad to be able to be there for him and glad for the way that it changed the nature of your relationship.
Yes, I was fortunate, as one is fortunate, I think, to be alongside somebody very valuable and dear to you when they're experiencing dying. It goes without saying that you can furnish some comfort if whatever comfort could come through to a dying person, and there is some. But in addition, to be present at the closing of a life that was important to you is important, very important. It was to me.
You went through, almost an epiphany while cleaning your father's feces on the bathroom floor when he was sick.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did what any... what they used to be called nurse's aide. I don't know what they're called now, but a nurse's aide does in a hospital for the ill. To be sure, it's something that most of us aren't accustomed to doing or trained to doing, unless we're tending small infants. And then, of course, we do deal with feces, urine, vomit, and so on and so on. But, of course, we're unused to doing this for each other as adults. unless it's something we do professionally, like a nurse or a doctor, some kind of a medical helper. And my father had come out of the hospital where he'd had a biopsy for this brain tumor. It was an innocuous procedure, they call it, but, you know, it had been pretty traumatic and trying for him, and he was battling, but he was tiring. And when he got to our house and was visiting with us, his bowel regularity had been thrown off by the hospital stay, and so he had what's politely called an accident. As he said it, I beshat myself. I thought it was a rather elegant formulation for a man in the midst of that travail, really. And I sort of found him in the bath. He was trying to deal with this himself. Well, it's like a child trying to deal with changing a diaper, an infant. It couldn't be done. And so I put him in the shower and helped him wash himself down, put him to bed. And then I came back and deal with this mess. Now, as I said in the book, I just as soon would have nailed the door shut to the bathroom and ruled that room off limits for the rest of our lives. I didn't want to do this any more than anybody else does. But it had to be done, and what the hell. So I went in there and used all the appropriate cleaning devices and did it, and was as, you know, gagged as everyone does, and was as nauseated as anybody else would be, and didn't much care for it. And yet when it was over, I felt, yes, this is okay. That was all right. I don't want to belabor this because it can become maudlin. It didn't feel maudlin at the time. It felt like a powerful experience. And that it seemed to me there was a certain rightness in the task I had been called upon to perform.
When your father died, I don't know how observant you are as a Jew, but when your father died, did you sit shiver?
No.
For our listeners who might know, shiva is the mourning period, and the way of sitting in mourning in the Jewish religion. Did you go through a crisis about whether to do it out of respect for him or whether he would have wanted you to do it, and so on and so on?
No. I'm not connected to institutional Judaism, and I have my own private institutions.
Mm-hmm. How observant was your father?
Well, he was rather typical, I think, of men of his generation. My father was born in 1901. He was very skimpily educated. He just went through grade school and then went off when he was 13 years old to work in a factory and worked all his life. He was not learned in anything particularly except in life, which is okay. But he was not a student of a Jewish religion or rituals or customs. His father had been trained as a rabbi, though he didn't work as one, and so he knew all the stuff, but he was a deeply secularized Jew. His connection to Jews was profound, passionate, all-pervasive, but his connection to institutional Judaism or the institutions of the religion was wasn't marginal as much as it was conventional, you know?
Yeah.
He went to the synagogue and so on. But he enjoyed the synagogue because of the people he saw there and the social opportunity it provided to be among like-minded people, more for that than for prayer and communion with God. But, you know, how do I know what kind of community
right,
he had there?
Right, right.
So I say that and then I withdraw it halfway.
Right. Philip Roth is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Philip Roth. He has a new novel called Operation Shylock, A Confession. Before you started writing about Jewish life, Jewish culture, did you think that your life, your kind of life, could be the subject of fiction?
No. I think one of the discoveries that a young writer makes is just this thing you're pointing to. It's a key discovery, and that is that my little place here, this X Street and Y Street and Z Street, that this place is as much the stuff of fiction as anything else. Strange that it should be so difficult to make this discovery. But what happens, of course, is for people like me who discover books in college, you read what's called literature with an L, you read the great writers, and you somehow can't associate, stupidly, by the way, or let's just naively or youthfully, you can't associate your little place, whether it's called Newark or Akron or Dayton or Louisville or whatever, and Joyce's Dublin, because it's Joyce. That's what gets in your way. But if you go back and just think, he wrote a book called Dubliners, why can't I write a book called Newarkers?
So what made you realize that you could write about your area of the world?
I think that I just got a little smarter in my early 20s, abandoned the derivative kind of short stories that I, and I think most budding writers write, and realized that this place that I'd come out of and that interested me, that rather I would put it this way, that this had been given to me.
You know, Zuckerman, at the end of your book, The Facts, the Zuckerman character who's commenting on the memoir that Philip Roth has written says, look, this place you come from does not produce artists so much as it produces dentists and accountants.
Oh, he's right on the right on the money, right on the money there. My four closest friends all became doctors. Uh-huh. So it seems to produce doctors in a proportion of 4-1 over writers.
Did you feel like it would be extra special hard for you to become a writer because the place that you're from is more likely to produce accountants and dentists?
Well, as my greatly gifted colleague Saul Bellow says, that boys like us have to anoint themselves. I mean, you've got to pour the oil over your own head, you know. But I was helped. I had no models in the neighborhood, that was for sure. But once you begin to discover books, the idea, if you're a bookish young fellow, an ambitious young fellow, the idea becomes less strange to you.
Early in your career, you became known for writing about Jewish life from a kind of ironic perspective. You're still writing about a lot of Jewish themes. What keeps you writing about that? And, you know, I'll mention parenthetically that it's not the faith, obviously. I mean, because you don't really practice.
Mm-hmm. But then, as we know that Jewish life is considerably more than the faith.
Yes.
Or let's put it another way, the predicament of Jews is of interest to me. Uh-huh. If we drop the word life in this context, where we can make it clearer to the audience that the historical predicament of Jews right down to whatever day this is in 1993 is not only of interest to me, but I have an instinctive, I think, understanding or feel for it. But to retrace the question you asked, let's go back to the example I gave of Joyce. I'm using Joyce, the greatest master of 20th century prose, not because I consider myself to be his equal as a writer. I'm using him as a convenient example that everybody knows. What kept Joyce writing about Dublin all his life? Here was a man who fled Ireland when he was a young man, hated it, by the way, loathed it, and lived his life as a kind of rootless cosmopolite, the Nazi a tag for Jews. But Joyce lived as a kind of rootless cosmopolite throughout Europe, never returned to Dublin, and yet based the most difficult, enormous, monstrous novels of the 20th century, monstrous in the very best sense, Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses, on the streets he'd walked as a boy in Dublin. And I would just respond to your question by saying, the Jews are my Irish. And Newark and Jerusalem and Prague, those cities are my Dublin. And this is what I have, I think, in many ways, been fortunate enough to have been given. And at the heart of Operation Shylock is the issue of the relationship between the Jew and the West, the relationship between the Jew and history, written in from historical or philosophical context, but these issues flowed through my frail frame as a kind of combatant in this Jewish war. I don't mean the war against the Arabs, I mean the war within the Jewish soul. So that's my long answer to your brief question.
What is the war within the Jewish soul?
Well, in the book, for instance, we find this fellow who did indeed pretend to be me, went around Jerusalem selling a doctrine he called diasporism, which is that he wanted to do is get the Jews out of Israel. He's a kind of anti-Moses, taking the Jews out of Israel back to Europe, where he says they can avert the Holocaust, which will befall them in the Middle East. And that his point was that Jews don't belong in this state. This state is only endangering them further. Jews belong in the world. The Zionist argument is just the opposite, which is you Jews are crazy to live in the world. You are endangered in the world. And you must come and live here. What's at the core of this conflict is danger. And what's at the core of that danger is anti-Semitism. And what I think I wrote in Operation Shylock is a book about my adventures, not at the heart of darkness, but at the heart of the Jewish obsession with anti-Semitism.
I can't tell whether you're speaking in persona or in fact when you say that when you're in Israel, you met somebody who used your name, pretended mm-hmm. they were you, and promoted this theory mm-hmm. of diasporism.
Let's pursue this, okay? I understand your skepticism. It's not the first. You're not the first skeptical reader who's a skeptical and intelligent reader, by the way, who's confronted this book and said to me, "Oh, come on, this is a novel," and this is not an illegitimate reading. It happens to be a wrong reading, but it's not illegitimate, and I can see what I can see all the things that it arises from, but it just ain't so. Preposterous things happen to everyone. Unlikely things happen to everyone. I think that in our world, rather unlikely things often happen to writers. This fellow, who bore a very strong resemblance to me, and as we all know, there are many people in the world who look like us, decided to go off on a lark or a scam or something. I have not penetrated what he was up to, but did indeed go off to Israel with his lady friend and announce that I had arrived there. And the attempt was to exploit my reputation for whatever it may be for his own benefit, crazy benefit. So this led to further adventures, and anybody who's been involved with an intelligence service would not be skeptical, I believe, about what then ensued. And I got involved with an intelligence service peripherally and then did something for them. So that's what happened. Now, the fact that nobody wants to believe this is mightily amusing to me. For any number of personal reasons, it does not seriously disturb my composure because I know what happened. But it's amusing because for years I've been told about the books I write, beginning with Portnoy's Complaint, oh, he just writes about himself. They're only about himself. He can't make anything up. That's his story. And I lived with this and said, ladies and gentlemen, these are acts of imagination, whether you believe it or not. And what fell the a hero of Portnoy's Complaint or his sexual prowess, unfortunately, is not my own. Or what befell the heroes of the hero of the Zuckerman books, though drawn very often from biographical facts of my own, that the entire adventure taken together was not my adventure, and they insisted that it was. Now, I've written a book, to conclude, in which I say, ladies and gentlemen, this all happened to me. It's as you say, I can't make anything up. And all I meet with is resistance of those who say, oh, but you made all this up. So it is an ironic side to it, but that will pass, I think.
I'm going to briefly change the subject.
Mm.
I want to go back to Portnoy for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if Portnoy's Complaint is a disorder in which strongly felt ethical and altruistic impulses are perpetually warring with extreme sexual longings, often of a perverse nature, then, I don't want to make the assumption that, you know, Portnoy was you or that you felt what he felt or whatever. But I think for most people when they're younger, there is a kind of greater sexual urge that is often at odds with other urges. And then you get older and that cools off a little bit.
Don't be so sure.
Don't be so sure. Okay. Well, my question is, or was going to be, do you feel that you went through a stage in your life where the kind of sexual distraction cooled off, and if so, what else? What took its place? How did it affect you as a writer? Well, here we go.
Well, you ask a question I have to think about. A question full of assumptions.
Yes,
that
I'm first to admit it.
That I'm afraid I have to surgically dismember. Where do you get this idea that sexual desire cools off? What have you been reading?
What can I tell you?
I think that Portnoy's complaint was very much about a man of that age. And in that way, I don't mean to challenge what you're saying. I think it's true. It may well be that not only a different man, but a man of another age might be able to more cunningly negotiate the contradiction, seeming contradiction. And it might be that there's a certain amount of naivete, youthful naivete, though Portnoy's a man in his 30s, nonetheless, it might be a certain amount of youthful naivete in someone who even experiences this as a conflict and doesn't negotiate it more cunningly. It may be generational, too. It may have been that those of Portnoy's generation were ill-equipped because of X, Y, and Z factors to do anything but bang their heads against the extreme nature of the longings, the perverse nature of the longings, and their purported ethical mission. As for us old guys, I think that's another program.
Right. Okay. That's fine. Philip Roth, his new novel is called Operation Shylock, A Confession. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.